The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm peachy.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Marc Maron announced this week that he is ending his long-running interview podcast series, WTF. He was one of the earliest pioneers of the audio format that we would come to know and love as podcasting. In many ways, he is a forefather of this very show. Maron started it 15 years ago. It has aired nearly 2,000 episodes since it began. He's interviewed everyone from Barack Obama to Paul Thomas Anderson to Robin Williams, RIP. I mention this not because this segment is about WTF ending, but because it's one fewer big new media outlet for folks promoting stuff to hit up, which we had already planned on being the topic of discussion for this segment before even seeing that announcement, because there's a great piece in Vulture by Nicholas Kwa about the weird landscape of movie promotion at the moment. One of the things I think about a lot when considering the future of movies is the difficulty in breaking through the clutter of information out there to get folks to turn up for something in theaters. It's a big ask. Getting people to get off their couch and go to a movie theater is these days a bigger ask than it ever has been. And needless to say, this is also something that folks in publicity think about a lot. And they all seem to want to be jumping off of bridges while they think about the current media landscape. Here's a quote from here's just a passage from that story. Quote, somewhere along the line, the press rounds mutated into something unruly. 15 years ago, building national name recognition was a straight shot. A newspaper feature, a magazine cover, a morning show, a late night hit, the trades, some local spots. Today, the new media circuit resembles a maddening sprawl. Countless possible routes, none guaranteed. It's overwhelming, said one partner at a top PR firm. What used to be a matter of managing relationships is now a game of craps, and the truth is, no one's sure what works anymore, end quote. So, I mean, you've got the celebrity podcasts like WTF and Smartless. You've got TikTok influencers. You've got the brocasters like Joe Rogan and Theo Von. You got hits on College Game Day. There's the hot wing eating show, Hot Ones, right? There's more traditional late night guest spots still. The world has never offered more outlets to get people information about the thing you are doing, the work you are working on. But also, what works and what doesn't work has never been more uncertain. And the other thing that is uncertain here is which stars are best suited to pull off this new game of media, you know, hey, love me. I don't know what you would call that. The best job I've seen recently of this is Timothy Chalamet's press tour for A Complete Unknown. And this brings me great pain to say, because I have always taken great pride in hating Timothée Chalamet, but he crushed it. He crushed it on this tour. He did really charming spots on College Game Day. He did this tour of record stores where he was just talking about albums and like being a generally pleasant person to be around. He had this great spot on Theo Von. He did an extremely good job, right?
He showed up at his own lookalike contest.
Who among us hasn't wanted to do that? He actually did it. There was an interesting bit at the top of this Vulture piece that highlights Andrew Garfield's recent press tour for We Live in Time, which included hits on the Dax Shepard podcast, a show called Chicken Shop Day. I don't know what that is.
It's literally more successful. It's an interview show in which a woman interviews a person at a chicken shop, and I guess in some previous instance the two of them had like made flirty eyes at each other, and then for the promo here they made much more flirty eyes at each other, if I understand correctly. Like
I don't know. I'll
at
say
at the chicken shop.
Timothée Chalamet's performances seem to have been much more successful. I will say, like, in terms of measurable box office, right, A Complete Unknown grossed more than $140 million worldwide. Garfield's movie grossed 57 or so million. But just also anecdotally, I'll say I saw zero of Andrew Garfield's hits. I did not recognize any of the things they were talking about at the top of this piece, but I saw what felt like all of Chalamet's. He was all over the place. He just did viral hit after viral hit. Now, maybe that's the difference between Chalamet and Garfield. I don't know. The expansion of outlets does have one unambiguous positive. It means there are more voices and more places than ever to help people and products break through to the public, right? It's funny, I was discussing this with David C. Lowery this weekend on The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. He's the singer and guitarist for the bands Cracker and Camper Van Beethoven. He has a new solo album out, and he said there are more micro-influencers than ever before. And then he like quickly assured me, he's like, I don't mean this podcast, of course. You're not a micro-influencer. But
yeah, you're not even an influencer.
But it's a term I've actually used to describe the proliferation of podcasts like The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood, which is, again, it's more niche, right? It goes out to several hundred thousand people. It gets tens of thousands of listens, but it's not going to open a movie. You show up on The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood, your movie's not going to open at $10 million based on that. Sorry, folks. I would love it if it was the case. I can help you sell a couple dozen copies of your book. I can get a couple hundred people out to your movie, maybe, or get them to download it or watch your TV show. But, you're not getting the $50 million opening by showing up there. You put together a handful of appearances like that, though, right? And you start to break through. Again, there's more of these than ever out there. They're easier than ever to book. You just have to actually do it. It's weird. It's a weird time. Peter, what do you make of the fractured publicity landscape?
Well, I understand why PR professionals are frustrated here, because this is obviously a challenging environment to work in. There's no sort of set course. There's not even a kind of clear array of courses. And even if someone, one of the best points made in this piece is that even if someone successfully like charts a new media PR course, like this is the set of shows that I'm going to do for this movie and I'm going to behave this way, and it works really well, like the Chalamet example, which I will just say, when all of that was happening, Sonny, I got so much more Andrew Garfield shoved at me during that same time than I did Chalamet. The only thing that I had heard of that Chalamet did was appear at the Timothée Chalamet lookalike contest. I didn't know about any of the other stuff. Whereas Chicken Shop Date, I just felt like I heard a huge amount about. And that's not because I'm a Chicken Shop Date watcher. It was just that's what the algorithms and or headlines that I saw. In any case, it's hard to know. It's hard to know. Even if something works one time, it almost certainly won't work the next time. So you can't even do comps, right? Like look at a model and say, this worked for Timothée Chalamet. Let's do that for our star the next time, or even for Timothée Chalamet. The next time he has a movie that he's trying to run, like that he's trying to advertise, he's going to have to come up with a different new media campaign. That's frustrating. On the other hand, this is not new. This is just not new. It used to be, yes, that there was a sort of set procession that you could put your star through if you were on the in the PR game, right? There were certain types of morning shows and then the late night talk show and the celebrity profiles and certain types of magazines. And if you were you wanted to skew a little more male, you would go to Esquire. And if you wanted to do something else, you would go to Vogue. And I'm not quite enough of a magazine celebrity profile expert to like understand fully all the differences of exactly how that would have broken down in 1988. But like, yes, there was like a playbook that you could execute. On the other hand, a lot of the time that playbook didn't work and you didn't know why it didn't work. Was it because the star wasn't charming enough? Was it because the interviewers just decided to be mean? Was it because the movie itself just that they were promoting just wasn't all that good or interesting to people? And this is, I mean, you know, you talked about the box office there between Chalamet and Andrew Garfield's project, but the Chalamet project, a Bob Dylan biopic, like yeah. That's just obviously so much more commercial than whatever the thing that Garfield was in that I can't remember the name of and didn't see. And this just goes back to the oldest and most famous, maybe not the oldest, the most famous adage in Hollywood is William Goldman's, no one knows anything. Yeah. And it's no one knows anything about the creative, but also about how to get butts in seats. And you never know. You never know. The thing that you know most is if they liked it one time, they'll like it a second time. And that's why we get sequels. But this is also just a big problem that beyond Hollywood for the advertising industry that goes way, way back, long before the fractured new media industry, the old like TV era, sort of like peak cable era, mid 1990s adage that that was like common in the advertising industry was, well, I know half my ads are working. I just don't know which half. And think about what an advertiser would have known about their soap ad or I don't know what in 1998. On the one hand, they would have had this like their spend data and they would have had a little bit of like eyeballs data. But in some cases, they would have had their ad runs on a show that has a high viewership and the product sales don't change at all. And on the other hand, and in some cases, they would have had a different ad run during that same show and product sales would have changed dramatically. What worked? What was the thing that made people go out and buy this product? What is the thing that makes people go out and see the movie? No one knew 40 years ago. No one knows now. And it's a different environment, but that not knowing hasn't changed.
Yeah. I thought part of what was really interesting about that piece is something you sort of alluded to, Peter, right? Like a Bob Dylan biopic, and specifically sort of about Dylan going electric, was always going to be pretty commercially viable. But it was also going to be pretty commercially viable for people who had no awareness or connection to a lot of the stuff that Chalamet was doing on that press tour and that was like assumed to be super appealing, right? Like my father-in-law is like a huge Bob Dylan devotee and like he's not listening to Theo Vaughn or like being aware of Timmy Chalamet lookalike contests. Like that's just not, that is not something that he is doing. And so like, I can see how people found that press tour like super charming. And I think it was probably good for like Chalamet as a star, but it's not at all clear to me that had anything to do with the box office for that movie, except maybe that like some people saw him like sing somewhere. I'm like, okay, you know, maybe he's not going to totally suck as Bob Dylan. But I really struggle with the idea that that particular press tour had anything to do with the box office at all.
You know, whether or not it led to more ticket sales is certainly an open question. But I do think it helped cement the idea of Timothy Chalamet as this sort of
as a movie star,
cross-generational movies. Like stars have always opened or not opened movies. It depends on the movie being made and, you know, whatever. But there has been this kind of lack of actors in Hollywood with recognition and presence, I think, in recent years. And I do think that that tour was a very good example of somebody breaking out of that box or breaking into that box of that kind of rarefied, like, I mean, the dude's showing up on like courtside seats at New York Knicks games. And is pulling off a total Jack Nicholson in the 70s sort of vibe, right? Like, yeah. That's just different. We haven't had that in a long time. it feels
at the
like.
Same time, you know, someone like Michael B. Jordan is like fairly not forthcoming. Like he's actually fairly protective of his private life. And there was another vulture profile of him that had the sort of interesting bit of data that like the number one reason people who are polled like said they went to see Sinners was because of him. So yeah, I think this question of like what makes someone a movie star continues to be super interesting. I mean, it just may be that there are multiple paths to it. But it also, like, that fragmentation of the media landscape also argues increasingly for the idea that, like, movie stars still are important, right? I mean, you know, I think we were all, like, somewhat mixed on Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. But, like, Tom Cruise is a bona fide goddamn movie star. And he worked his ass off, like, personally in a more traditional way. And that it had the best opening weekend of the franchise, didn't it?
Yeah.
I think it did.
Yes. I'm not sure it had the best opening adjusted for inflation, but definitely in raw numbers, it did.
There was something that Peter mentioned just like very briefly in passing, you know, what the algorithm pushes to you.
Yes.
Which is the other big key part of this, because I experienced none of this from the primary source. I don't watch Hot Wings. I don't watch Chicken Shop Date, which sounds made up.
You don't watch any of the chicken theme podcasts.
Not convinced
between that, the two chickens
thing. I'm not convinced that's a real thing. Like I don't listen to Marc Maron, right? But I will occasionally hear clips from a Marc Maron podcast, and if there's somebody who I really like to hear talk, like Paul Thomas Anderson, etc., I'll listen to his episode. My point here is that I experience none of this firsthand, none of this from the primary source. I get it all through social media, which is an entirely different and, like, frankly, weirder and maybe harder egg to crack, to keep with the chicken metaphor. That has to be just as maddening for these guys, right?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think like there have been some recent changes in the social media algorithms that have sort of deprioritized news in some interesting ways. And like, you end up needing a team of engineers to sort of crack that. And I don't know how many publicists have that.
This, I think, is actually the real value of a successful new media tour. We talked about not knowing whether it's moving ticket sales, whether it's getting people to come out for a specific movie that you are advertising. But you are correct, Sonny, to say that a successful tour like that becomes its own kind of Hollywood star inertia. That allows Chalamet himself or his representatives to go to a studio next time and say, look, I can successfully advertise your movie better than somebody else who did not do a similar kind of tour, right? Because this tour was seen as successful, regardless of whether there's any real data about how many butts and seats, how many tickets it's actually sold, right? And in addition to that, it sort of becomes a self-making, like a self-fulfilling prophecy, because those clips, even if relatively small numbers of people are actually just sitting and like, oh, I watch every episode of Chicken Shop Date or whatever. And actually those shows, I think, do have reasonably large audiences, not like the old network audiences, but they have not trivial audiences, let's say. They are watched, but they are watched so much more in little clips that filter out online. And so when those things are successful, first of all, in their own native show formats, but then in this second social layer where the algorithms, where some combination of people liking these things and clipping them for sharing, and then the algorithms realize, oh, that was a good clip that's successful, I'm going to show it to more people, right? Like then your face ends up in front of more and more people, even people who aren't watching the show. And that makes you a kind of omnipresent presence. It gives you a sort of, does that use those words right?
An omnipresence.
Right. It gives you a kind of like you become omnipresent in the culture in a way that is a little hard to quantify and hard to see exactly like how valuable it is. On the other hand, I think to the extent that we know anything in Hollywood, it is clear that that kind of name recognition, especially when combined with a generalized fondness, when it's not extremely hostile or negative towards a person, like that kind of name recognition does ultimately do more for advertising your movie, for just letting, like, this is a thing that I think people, probably listeners of this show won't be that surprised, but people underrate how much PR is not about making people want to see it. It's just about literally letting them know that the movie exists.
Yeah.
Like that is the biggest hurdle to solve.
Awareness.
And so when you have a star who is, omnipresent, who is around and whose stuff gets traded through the algorithms and through his faces everywhere, then that helps a huge amount with just letting people know that future projects are happening and are out there. And it develops, like I said, its kind of own internal logic, its own inertia that does, I think, maybe not put butts in seats for the Bob Dylan movie that like was always going to do well unless people hated it, because it's a Bob Dylan movie and biopics generally do well. And also people love Bob Dylan. But the next thing he does that may not be quite as pre-sold and may not have quite as much kind of built-in name recognition for the product, he is going to be able to provide the name recognition himself.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
For the record, there's a site that service that tracks like social media impressions. It's called Relish Mix, I think.
Relish Mix is what you put on your chicken on one of the shows that you.
Yeah, exactly. That's a thing that you buy at Chicken Shop Day. No, Relish. But it's always very funny because it's like Relish Mix said that Dwayne Johnson put on his Instagram this, and that got 17 billion impressions, I find that to be a not entirely useful way to measure actual impact, but I do think that kind of tracking which of these clips goes viral and where they come from and who they spread to is interesting and hard to do, and yeah. Useful, frankly.
Yeah. I have no idea whether it's useful or not, but my favorite fact about Dwayne Johnson's social media is that I read once, it's possible I'm screwing this up because I don't have this in front of me, but I read like a couple of years ago that he has his very high rate that he gets paid, right? It's the $10 million, whatever the number is for doing a movie. And then if you want him to post even one time about it on Instagram or social media, it is it starts at an additional $1 million.
Ridiculous. I don't really have an exit question here, so I'll just remind everyone that The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood is now, with Mark Maron's W2EF shutting down, easily the biggest and best podcast that your publicity-seeking client can appear on. So book an interview with Sonny Bunch today if you want to go viral. I can help set that up. Just shoot me an email or slide into the comments here, and I'll get that set up. And now on to the main event. Lilo and Stitch, the live-action remake of the now-beloved 2002 cartoon from Disney, is a huge hit with audiences. It has grossed nearly $600 million in its first two weekends worldwide on a $100 million or so budget. A movie, it's worth noting, maybe, that was originally intended to be straight to Disney+, but the studio was like, let's throw it in theaters and see what happens. Throw it in theaters, folks. You don't want to miss out on that. It also earned a solid A from CinemaScore audiences. I just want to impress upon you with this litany that this is one of those critic-proof movies we sometimes talk about, right? It really doesn't matter what the critics said about this unless they were really savage about it. It was likely to do numbers simply because it's a movie made for kids, both boys and girls, typically, especially younger boys and girls, based on a now-beloved animated movie that had largely avoided any of the controversies that plagued the recent Snow White live-action flick. Anyway, the movie itself, Stitch is a monster, and he's on the run from the Galactic Federation of Planets, or equivalent, whatever, and he is exiled to live on Earth, which is derided as a mosquito farm by the aliens, which, you know, fair enough, where he is supposed to crash into the ocean and drown. Instead, he lands on the island of Hawaii, where he is adopted as a dog by Lilo, a little girl living with her overwhelmed sister, Nanny, who is trying to avoid having Lilo become a ward of the state after the death of their parents. Nanny is committed to keeping their family together to satisfy the idea of Ohana, which means family. And that family grows to include the monster dog, who makes everybody's lives more difficult. Hijinks ensue, and everyone learns a valuable lesson. And the kids in the theater are entertained. Look, I could complain, I could nitpick plot points of this movie. I could complain about its pointlessness. Again, it's a live-action remake of a cartoon. The cartoon simply looks more vibrant and exciting than this ever possibly could. I could complain about the occasionally janky special effects. Again, this was made for Disney+, and it looks it every once in a while. But this is just one of those things that's good enough. It's good enough. It entertains the target audience. And you know what? That's all you need. The last thing I will say is that there's been this kind of weird bipartisan horseshoe effort to gin up controversy about this movie's ending, which, spoiler, if you're really worried about spoilers for the remake of the 2002 animated classic Lilo and Stitch, just turn it off now. Because there is a slight difference between the endings here. In order to allow Nani to go to college and create a more stable home environment for Lilo, a kindly grandmother figure who lives next door and is like already kind of part of the Ohana, you know, ideal, is allowed to take Lilo in. She is given, you know, foster status. Due to some plot shenanigans, the older sister has a teleportation gun, which means the two sisters will never be far apart. Now, folks on the right have said this is a horrible rebuke of the importance of family in the name of the sister becoming a professional woman. Oh, God, what a terrible thing. Meanwhile, folks on the left have said that this plays into anti-Native tropes about the states taking away Native children and raising them in foster state care. Both of these takes are completely insane. They're just wrong. They're just objectively wrong. It's like a misreading of what happens in the movie itself. And it's kind of heartening to see that nobody in the real world cares about them. They just want to go see this movie. Anyway, Alyssa, what did you make of Lilo and Stitch?
I thought this was pretty charming. I think probably in part because I have a newly 7-year-old daughter. And so I think the actress who's playing Lilo here is, you know, quite a lot of fun. But you know, this is a movie, I think it's worth pausing for a second before I go into any of the serious stuff. It's just like how weird this movie is. It's like, this is a very strange story, right? And it's strange even sort of by the standards of what Pixar, you know, like Pixar's made a bunch of like odd movies, but it's just like Monster Dog plus 6-year-old orphan plus like, it's an odd idea for a movie. But I think what the original did well and what this version of the movie does really well are get at the fact that 6-year-olds, like kids that age, are still in the process of becoming civilized. But as they discover sort of moral sense, that question of like, am I bad, is actually, you know, one of kids' first big collisions with morality, right? The question of like, am I an inherently good or bad person, you know, at the same time that like you're brain is not fully developed, right? Like kids are impulsive. They find it challenging to like stay on task and on focus and listen to directions. You know, the qualities of kind of curiosity and, you know, sort of a desire to explore things can be really sort of consequential at that age and dangerous. And they're good qualities that can have downsides until they're harnessed. And so I think the movie does a good job of kind of exploring that question and like leaving space. Like Lilo's, you know, impulsivity has real consequences for her sister, right? Like she gets her sister, like her behavior gets her sister fired. It makes it harder for her to find work. But it's also like she's not bad. She's a curious kid who's been through something really difficult. And I actually think that that's one place where the switch to live action actually serves the story a little bit. Like, I don't necessarily think that it's like a worthwhile decision overall, but I think that by having Lilo be a real little girl instead of like a super cute cartoon avatar, it actually, that foregrounds the sort of spikiness of that age a little bit. It like, instead of just sort of shrugging off, you know, all of her antics as like cartoon Muppet adorableness, it's like, oh no, this is a real child. And she's both like very appealing and engaging, but like the idea of like a 6-year-old threatening to like jump out the window of her bedroom or, you know, like setting a bunch of stuff on fire accidentally, like actually gains a little bit more weight. And Stitch is a really good, you know, maybe in a way that I'm not sure I appreciated it when I was 18 when this original movie came out. Like Stitch is a good avatar for that, you know, sort of 6 to 7-year-old age where you're someone with like a lot of impulses and energy and in some cases like real capabilities, but like none of the sort of control, like impulse control or perception. And, you know, I think that that is, it's the rare movie that speaks to what it's actually like to be that age in some ways, in a, you know, a sort of more sophisticated and child developmentally aware way than I think most movies do. Like, Lilo is not like some magical little child. She's like, she feels like a real human, both in the original and in this new version. I also think the actress who plays her sister is quite good and does an excellent job of conveying the sort of just like trying to be someone's mom when you don't have your own life together. I think the acting elevates a remake that was unnecessary and, you know, a concept that's just really incredibly bizarre. I found this pretty charming.
Well, also the original Lilo and Stitch is a sad movie. Like it is a movie that is steeped in sadness. Like lots of Disney movies have dead parents. Like this is kind of the joke.
Yeah.
Right? If you're a parent in a Disney movie, watch out because you've got bad things coming to you.
Right.
But this is an especially sad one because again, this is not like a wealthy, it's not like a princess in a
castle.
There is
no fairy godmother coming down to like solve these problems, right? Like what you get is like a weird blue monster dog. Like you get an agent of chaos. And yeah, these are not problems that can be solved by magic. Like it's, you know, even the aliens who are sent to invade Stitch are like sort of incompetent and bumbling. Like it's a universe kind of without magic in an interesting way. And it is sad. It is like there are real, you know, there are real world consequences to losing your parents. And I do think it's interesting that the movie sort of leans so heavily into like Medicaid is important and like the foster system is a real thing. It is the rare Disney live action movie where the switch to live action kind of adds to some of the gravity of the plot.
Yeah. Peter, you had Medicaid questions about this movie, some of the plot mechanics.
Yeah.
How it actually worked.
Okay. So part of my work at Reason Magazine, I've written an awful lot about healthcare, especially when the Affordable Care Act was being debated and then implemented. It's been a long, long time working on that. And so, of course, learned a bit about Medicaid since about half of the first 10 years of the Affordable Care Act spending coverage expansion was through Medicaid. It's, of course, now also part of our political debate right now because there are reductions to planned spending in Medicaid being as part of the One Big Beautiful Bill, which there's nothing else you can call that, by the way. That's literally the title of the bill, like in the legislation. I don't know. Anyway, the thing that the big spending bill that's moving through the House and is now in the Senate. Right. So, you know, Medicaid is something that I have kind of a policy interest in, and the movie does some odd things with Medicaid, or with what I presume is Medicaid, because so this is, I think, sort of this is to me the actual strange part of this movie, because I find the kind of core setup of here is a blue alien monster dog who also is kind of like a 6 year old, right? And both is both like in some ways like a pet like friend, but also mirrors the kind of chaos and both the emotional and physical chaos of a young kid. Like that's actually a pretty straightforward kids movie setup, right? Is like let's put that chaos in a cute form, right? And then put them together and see what happens.
But I would also emphasize like kind of scary and gross. And I think that's one of the things that makes this movie, that makes Lilo and Stitch as a story like sort of more subtle and interesting about children than the vast majority of children's media. Cause like 6 year olds can be kind of freaky. They can be kind of disgusting or weird or like, you know, just sort of odd. And a willingness to sort of acknowledge that and have that be part of the manifestation is, I think, really like is interesting and sort of acute in a way that I think Disney has not always been.
So. Yeah, no. That's I agree with that. And I think, I mean, I really enjoyed the original, though I haven't seen it probably in 20 something years. Very fond memories of seeing it with my younger siblings. But this one leans much more into the kind of state policy aspect of the story and allows that to be a driver of the narrative in ways that I just think are kind of strange. And so you know, it's the setup, as you've said, is you have these two sisters, one of whom is an adult, right, is 19 years old and has a job, not a great job, but a job when the movie starts. And then when she loses her job, tries to get another one, is acting about as responsibly as you can imagine a 19-year-old acting. They have a house together that is, yes, somewhat messy. Although, frankly, you look at the mess in this house and it's all cute mess. It's pretty much all like photogenic, like it's not the kind of real mess that you see in like truly it's in
it's look, not if, dirty it's messy so, it's not dirty
I mean we don't I don't know how much we want to get into this, but if you know anything about cases where kids are likely to end up in foster homes, the homes they are being taken out of in many cases are, let's just say, very highly disordered in multiple ways. They're not just messy, they're a something beyond that. And it obviously varies case to case and it's complicated. But this movie doesn't sort of gives us a kid friendly, a family movie friendly version of that, that in some ways makes the plot even weirder, because this is, look, it's obviously a very difficult situation when you lose your parents, but this is fundamentally a loving home with a person who is working, who is related to you, who loves the little kid, right, and has like her best interest at heart. And you have this social worker who comes in and is like, if you can't clean up and get things in order, we might have to put Lilo, make her a ward of the state. And in particular, the final thing you have to do, she gives her a list, is you have to sign up for health insurance. Well, of course, the Stitch situation, the little furry blue monster, makes too much chaos to get around to signing up for health insurance. So at the end of the second act, we have our shadow of death, our moment of like true peril, in which Lilo appears to maybe have drowned in a surfing accident and gets taken to the hospital. Okay, so the good news is she's basically fine. No real worries. But the doctor is like, you can just give your health insurance information to the person at the desk. They'll take care of it. And of course, she hasn't signed up for health insurance. So here, the social worker steps in and says something that does not make any sense to me. And maybe you guys understood this, and it makes like, you can explain the policy aspect of this in a way that I and several Medicaid experts that I talked to could not. But she says, I don't have the quote in front of me, but it's very close to, there's a way the state can pay for this, but you will have to relinquish Lilo officially once and for all. And so what she is saying is, it's true, Medicaid, which is presumably the way that the state is going to pay for a healthcare bill, Medicaid does in fact offer retroactive coverage. So people can sign up for it and get paid and get covered for the previous 3 months of medical expenses, so long as they are qualifying. So there is a retroactive coverage feature within Medicaid, but I couldn't find anyone who could explain why accepting that would necessitate.
Because of the movie, you got all hung up on this. It's just plot mechanics. That's all it is.
But it's a weird plot mechanic to make this whole thing about like social worker, like, I don't know if it's technically CPS, but it's something like CPS, right? Taking away a kid and making Medicaid require, like, to accept Medicaid, you have to give up guardianship. It's just an odd decision for a kid's movie.
Yeah, I think it doesn't make a lot of sense. Also, frankly, like, a social worker would have like sat with her and done the paperwork and like signed her up for benefits.
Yes, right? Like long before this had happened. Instead of saying you got to do it yourself while walking away from the house and threatening to take the kid away in a week.
I don't think we should make too much of this, but I do think it's a weird mistake when like there's a perfectly logical beat in that story where Nani is like realizes like, oh, I am overwhelmed, right? Like, I didn't do this thing. I didn't keep my sister safe. Like, I don't have a job. And actually is like, oh my God, I do need some help. And I think that would have been more deft writing in that scene and would have made the whole thing like less coercive in a way that I think does inject a sort of unnecessarily sour note in the movie. And look, I have done a bunch of reading and a little bit of reporting on the foster system, and I would not pretend to be an expert on it at all. But I can totally see a scenario where there is like a social worker pretty actively involved in the lives of these kids just to like make sure that Lilo's in a safe environment, but also like for Nani too, right? To like, to see whether she's like able to be a guardian, but also like where a good social worker might be like, What are your other options? How do we make this work for everybody? And so I think there are...
Like, I agree with all that, to be clear. Yeah. Like a check-in from a concerned social worker in a situation where two kids have lost their parents, totally reasonable. Even suggesting like there are things you could and should do to make life here much better. On the other hand, this the threat of like, if you don't do this set of things, we're going to take your, like, we're going to take her away is just a weird thing to hang so much of this, the plot of this movie on.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And I think that you could have made some very small adjustments to this screenplay that would.
And it's not in the original. And it's like, it's not nearly to this extent that the original is a movie that does not in any way, like, ring your, like, what's going on with Medicaid alarm bells? Like, did they get the Medicaid policy wrong, like, in this? Though, granted, I haven't, like I said, I haven't seen it in 20 years. But no, like, it's, and this is the other thing that I just wanted to say was, this movie is okay. And I love a cute, like, charming, like, animal dog, right? I've got big dogs, and they're funny, and one of them's a puppy right now. And he's kind of destructive, but it's incredibly charming, and I can't, you know, ever be mad when I come outside every day and find giant holes dug in my yard for no good reason, or yet another stuffed thing destroyed all over my house. It's just, he's a cute little puppy, and I love him, and he's kind of wild and crazy, and it's actually kind of enjoyable, the wildness and the craziness, because he's so cute. He's got these big eyes just like Stitch, and that part is good, but I have such fond memories of seeing this movie, which was one of the very last hand-drawn animated Disney films, you know, I think in, 2002, and when I saw this, I would have been about 20 years old. I definitely remember seeing it with my two younger siblings, one of whom 13 years younger than me, so who was about 7 years old, six, 7 years old at that time, maybe right around there. And it was just such a gentle and sweet film that, like, we as siblings of a quite large age range were able to, I don't know, like, not deeply bond. It's not something we talk about 20 years later, but, like, we're able to, like, really find a connection over, right? And, like, this was something that could appeal to all of us at different stages of our kind of childhood and just past childhood. And it's really hard for me to imagine, like, that this version of this movie working that way for a 7-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 20-year-old set of, you know, male and female siblings. Like, this is a movie that's aimed at kids, and it works well enough for them. And yes, like I said, I like the ways in which Stitch was like a dog, but this movie doesn't try to kind of be the movie that becomes enough of a classic that people remember it and buy Stitch toys for 20 years and then they remake it. This movie doesn't try to be that. It just tries to be good enough and serviceable enough for the thing, for this sort of, I don't know. And it's fine. It's good and serviceable enough, right?
Yeah. But I think it's also just depressing to have, if you like, as your corporate tagline, Disney, serviceable enough. You know?
It's much better than Snow White.
Yeah.
That's a million better. Times. It's so much better than that. It's much better than that. That's for sure. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Lilo and Stitch? Alyssa?
I like moderate thumbs up, but the original is better.
Peter?
I'm going to have to give this a thumbs down because I just didn't actually enjoy this enough to give it a thumbs up. But if you're 8, it's probably fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thumbs up for me just on the basis of, like, look, it works for the target audience. My daughter has seen it twice. She loves it. My son, who also went to see Snow White and, like, was so bored he wanted to leave the movie theater, enjoyed it fine. So, like, this works for the intended audience, and as such gets a thumb up from me. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Rupert Manderstam, without whom this program would sound much worse. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter, @SunnyMunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Switching between different tools to finish a project can feel stressful and disjointed, especially while juggling tight deadlines in a fast-paced work environment. Now, there's a better way. Grammarly built a writing surface that's a game changer for professionals. It helps move your ideas forward and sharpen your words for better results, all in one place. With Grammarly's AI agents, you get writing support at every step to bring polish and impact to your emails, reports, and proposals without the tab overload. Email sounds robotic, phrasing feels off, writing for a high-stakes client. Grammarly's got you covered. You can even ask Grammarly's AI chat to help brainstorm brilliant proposals, summarize meeting notes in seconds, or even shape a winning sales strategy, all right from your doc. 93% of professionals say that Grammarly helps them get more done. And now it's your turn. Sign up for free and get stronger results. Faster work, smarter sentences, clearer finishes. Visit Grammarly.com to get started. That's Grammarly.com. Switching between tools for one project gets disjointed, especially on tight deadlines. Grammarly built a game-changing writing surface tailor-made for professionals to help you move your ideas forward and sharpen your writing. You can brainstorm ideas, summarize meeting notes in seconds, or strengthen a proposal without context switching. Easy to get started and even easier to finish. Sign up for Grammarly free and get your professional writing from draft to done. Visit Grammarly.com. That's Grammarly.com.